Next, an excerpt from Dana Milbank's book, Homo Politicus, The Strange and Scary Tribes That Run Our Government. Deep within the forbidding land encircled by the Washington Beltway lives the tribe known as Homo Politicus. Their ways are strange, even repulsive, to civilized human beings. Their arcane rites often impenetrable, their language coded and obscure. Violating their complex taboos can lead to sudden, harsh, and irrevocable punishment. Normal Americans have long feared Homo Politicus, and with good reason, but fearless anthropologist Dana Milbank has spent many years immersed in the dark heart of Washington, D.C., and has produced this indispensable portrait of a bizarre culture whose tribal ways are as hilarious as they are outrageous.
This was a brilliant discovery. Suddenly, thousands of journalists and lobbyists in Washington could be prosecuted for doing business the way they have routinely done it for decades. Any one of them could be sacrificed. The unlucky victims turned out to be two officials from the pro-Israel lobby, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. The FBI arranged a sting operation to catch the lobbyists doing what they did quite openly, collecting information about American foreign policy and talking about it with anybody who would listen. They were caught having lunch with a mid-level Pentagon analyst, Larry Franklin, in 2003 above the Roslyn metro station at an Italian restaurant called Tivoli. After the FBI confronted Franklin, they demanded he help them net Steve Rosen, who had built AIPAC, into a powerful lobbying outfit, and AIPAC official Keith Weissman. Franklin had little choice but to agree, donning a wire and passing information to Weissman outside Nordstrom at the Pentagon City Mall in Virginia. The two lobbyists, understandably, saw no reason to keep their information secret. The law, as everybody understood it, punished leakers, not leakees. They spoke about it with journalists, friends of the White House, and the Israeli embassy. But under the newly revised Espionage Act, the two men were indicted along with Franklin. Weissman and Rosen earned the distinction of being the first non-government officials to be prosecuted for merely possessing classified information. The prosecutor said this would teach people that they must resist the temptation to acquire classified information. The two lobbyists sought to toss out the charges, pointing out accurately that what they did is what members of the media, members of the Washington policy community, lobbyists, and members of congressional staffs do perhaps hundreds of times every day. The judge pointed out that it's irrelevant whether the law makes sense or not because it's still on the books. Though it owed its very existence to Rosen, AIPAC quickly joined in the sacrifice, firing him and Weissman for behavior beneath the standards AIPAC sets for its employees. This was clearly false. Rosen and Weissman were doing exactly what they were paid to do, but AIPAC was eager to keep itself from being added to the sacrifice. It eventually stopped paying legal bills for the two. At AIPAC's 2006 convention, some delegates were asked about the treatment of Rosen. "I'm not the person to ask about that," said Nathan Diamant, a Washington representative for Orthodox Jews. "Who?" responded Neil Cooper, a delegate from the Philadelphia area. "Rosen, which one is he?" answered a charity executive with a smile. "I need to read more about it," demurred Eaton Cohen, a college student. Only secretly would they admit the obvious. "I don't like the way AIPAC handled it, hanging them out to dry," said one West Coast delegate, after delivering an on-the-record no comment. "They didn't do anything different from what everybody else does in this town every day." Sin eaters, flat catchers. The notion of a scapegoat is, of course, a biblical one. As part of the Hebrews' atonement, the sins of the tribe were transferred to a goat, which was driven into the wilderness. The Aztecs had a similar device. The goddess Tlazoltliotl ate the sins of those who confessed to her. One fascinating aspect of Potomac culture is that some members of the community exist almost entirely to be abused for sins committed by others. One of the most common work roles among Potomac men is the flack, a person who serves as a spokesman for another person or agency. The flack's job is to prevent the public from knowing what the person or agency he represents is actually doing. This can be accomplished either by creating false accounts or by refusing to answer questions at all, a process known as stonewalling. Predictably, this role sets the flack up for a great deal of hostility from people in the news media who are trying to obtain a correct version of events. The journalists, unable to get the information they seek, resort to heckling the flak in televised briefings. The most memorable of these spear catchers in recent years has been Scott McClellan, a White House press secretary who had the bad luck to be speaking for the president during the Valerie Plame scandal. McClellan, wittingly or unwittingly, conveyed to the press the utter falsehood that neither Scooter Libby nor Karl Rove had leaked the identity of the CIA operative. When McClellan was later proven to be either a dupe or a liar, he was exposed to televised taunts in the White House briefing room. "This is ridiculous. You're in a bad spot here, Scott. Have you consulted a personal attorney? You're not saying anything. There's been a wound to your credibility here. Your credibility may very well be on trial with the American public, don't you agree?" The spokesman absorbed the blows so that his superiors didn't have to. His responses were suitably meek. "I'm very confident in the relationship that we have in this room and the trust that has been established between us," the spokesman said. "We can't vouch for you," one of his interrogators shot back. "That's not our job. Have you considered resigning?" McClellan did not consider resigning. Right up to March 2006, he told colleagues he planned to stay on the job, but Bush had other ideas, and the loyal McClellan was told he had to go. Having exhausted all his credibility in defending the White House's falsehoods, he was no longer of use, other than as a sacrifice. "I have given it my all, sir," he said to Bush, choking up on the South Lawn. The two then boarded Marine One for a symbolic farewell, but the helicopter wouldn't fly, and they had to depart by car. McClellan had the bad luck of following an earlier flak, Ari Fleischer, who had the advantage of freeing himself from the normal bounds of logic that constrain human conversation. When troops failed to find the weapons the White House insisted Iraq had, for example, Fleischer reasoned, "I think the burden is on those people who think he didn't have weapons of mass destruction to tell the world where they are." After McClellan's sacrifice, President Bush quickly found a new flak, conservative commentator Tony Snow from Fox News, who armed himself with a new defense: ignorance. "You're asking me a state of mind question that predates me," Snow said at his first briefing. "I'm not even going to try to fake it. I will apologize as the new kid on the block. For today, I'm not going to handle international issues or currency issues. I don't wish to set off global tempests because I frankly just don't know enough on those. You'll forgive me, but I'll do the talking points on this because, again, as the new kid on the block, I'm not fully briefed into everything." "You're getting ahead of my brief. I don't know any more than I told you." "I won't get ahead of my brief on this. You'll have to ask General Hyden. You'll have to ask the folks on Capitol Hill. You'll have to ask the Senate committee. Can't confirm or deny. I can't comment." Such answers would buy Snow time until the inevitable point when, his credibility also in tatters, he too would be sacrificed. While reporters content themselves with the humiliation of flaks, those Potomac men in elected office demand the ritual sacrifice of higher-level officials. Lawmakers prefer to confront their victim in a committee hearing room, not a briefing room, staring down from the dais at their victim in the witness stand. Sometimes Potomac man demonstrates his power over other cultures by forcing people from outside Potomac land to appear before their committees. Baseball players who use steroids, oil company executives reaping windfall profits, or corporate wrongdoers from companies such as Hewlett-Packard. Far more often, the elected officials demand that a representative of the administration be offered as a sacrifice. A classic of this form was the ritual sacrifice demanded on Capitol Hill after the Department of Homeland Security cut counterterrorism funding for New York City and the Washington area by 40%, even though the two had suffered 100% of Al-Qaeda's terrorist attacks on American soil. DHS concluded that the nation's capital is a low-risk city for terrorism and that the Statue of Liberty, Brooklyn Bridge, and Empire State Building are not worthy of national icon status. Instead, terrorism magnets such as Kansas City and St. Louis got increases, as well as the horses of Louisville, the cattle of Omaha, the bison of Montana, and five cities in Florida, where the president's brother was the governor. The White House had no intention of changing its mind. It wouldn't even release the data it used to make its decisions, but it was willing to make one concession. It would offer George Forsman, the DHS official in charge of disaster preparedness. Forsman was hauled to two committees so that everybody could toss their spears at him. First came the House Government Reform Committee. One of the greatest displays of incompetence, judged Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney of New York. "It does boggle the mind," agreed Jim Moran of Virginia. Florida's John Mica added, I've never seen a goofier list of priorities. You really think, Chairman Tom Davis demanded, that Montana is at a higher risk than D.C.? Forsman, his hands trembling slightly, replied weakly, Congressman, there are all kinds of intricacies. Next came the House Homeland Security Committee. It was indefensible, it was disgraceful, and to me it raises very, very real questions about the competency of this department in determining how it's going to protect America, said the chairman, Peter King of New York. This was a stab in the back to the city of New York. Several others piled on with similar epithets. Forsman, seated in the first row, fidgeted, scratched his brow, and pinched his nose. As befits a sacrifice victim, he had no real defense, just some technical talk about empirically driven, analytically based ability to allocate dollars. Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas proposed Forsman stop the nightmares of philosophical gobbledygook. I don't like the situation we all find ourselves in, Forsman admitted at one point. I'm sure it wasn't a pleasant experience, King sympathized. But Forsman knew his role was to accept sacrifice willingly. It was actually a phenomenally positive experience, he said gamely. Chapter 11, Fertility Rights and Mating Behaviors. In his study of the Nuer, the tribe of herdsmen in the Nile Basin, the anthropologist E.E. Evans Pritchard detailed the elaborate bride price that must be paid by a groom to the family of his bride. The father of the bride gets 8 head of cattle, 3 cows, 3 calves, and 2 oxen. A brother of the same mother gets 7 head, 2 oxen, 4 cows, and 1 calf. The mother of the bride gets a cow, a calf, and a heifer, while the bride's brother from another mother gets 2 cows. Another 20 head are divided among siblings of the bride's father and mother. The tendency to view courtship as an extension of commerce is, of course, as ancient as the Roman abductions of the Sabine women. In modern times, the custom has faded, except among certain primitive tribes, such as the Yanomami of the Amazon. When running low on women, bands of Yanomami men arrange raids on neighbors to kidnap their women and make the captives their wives. Among advanced civilizations, sexual relations are considered to be a pleasurable activity, and love is widely viewed to be a human need, a worthwhile end in itself. But Homo Politicus regards love and mating as he does all aspects of life, an opportunity to demonstrate or enhance power. Here, men and women at the low end of the power structure treat sex and love as means of obtaining power. Those at the upper end use these relationships to display to the larger community the status they've already attained. It's generally not as formal as the Nuer bride payments or as violent as the Yanomami abductions, but Potomac mating is every bit as commercial. What Potomac man considers to be a love relationship would, in other civilizations, be called a strategic alliance. Because of the transactional nature of Washington love, relationships here tend to end badly. Not necessarily with broken hearts, but often with broken contracts. Sometimes the less powerful partner in the relationship concludes that the partnership is not providing the increased status sought. Other times, the more powerful partner, having exhibited power by winning the lover, loses interest in the transaction. In either case, it's common for Washington lovers to resolve disputes with the assistance of lawyers and public relations consultants. These are the people who must negotiate and arrange any refund of the bride price. The transactional nature of love and sex in Washington today owes much to former President Bill Clinton, who, by receiving oral sex in the West Wing on Easter Sunday, redefined for Potomac men the boundaries of acceptable romantic activity. Clinton, affectionately described as a pussy man by his friend and confidant Vernon Jordan, survived the resulting impeachment by the House of Representatives, leading many other Washingtonians in the years since then to follow the trail he blazed. In a sense, Clinton was merely continuing a long-standing Washington practice. Senator Chuck Robb, a Virginia Democrat, was bedeviled by the nude back rub he received from a former beauty queen. Clinton advisor Dick Morris was banished because of an episode of toe-sucking at the Jefferson Hotel. Bob Livingston declined to be Speaker of the House because Hustler magazine was on the trail of his infidelities. But the knowledge that a married president of the United States could have an affair with an intern but not lose his job emboldened Potomac Man to see just how much he could get away with. Can a married congressman settle a lawsuit claiming he spent years beating and abusing a woman half his age and still cruise to re-election? Of course he can. Can a leader of the House of Representatives win a promotion after divorcing his wife and marrying a lobbyist while doing legislative favors for the lobbyist company? Absolutely. Can a senator win re-election after the discovery that one of his staff members was using Senate computers to write a sex diary and run a prostitution business while at work? Why not? Can a legislator keep his job even after the skeletal remains of his mistress were found in Rock Creek Park? Well, even modern Washington has its limits. Power as an aphrodisiac. Potomac Man is frequently surprised to find that his power does not necessarily serve as an attractant to potential mates who are not part of the political sphere. It can be a devastating discovery for a powerful Potomac Man to learn that his appeal is limited only to fellow Potomac Men. This was the painful experience of Mike Ferguson, a Republican congressman from New Jersey, when he visited the Rhino Bar and Pump House in Georgetown one spring night in 2003. Ferguson had developed Potomac Man's trademark sense of entitlement at a tender age. For his 30th birthday in 2000, Ferguson's wealthy parents bought their son a seat in Congress. The Federal Election Commission later assessed him a $210,000 penalty for taking more than $500,000 in excessive contributions from his parents, but Ferguson got to keep his congressional seat. And so Ferguson found himself at the Rhino Bar at 1 a.m. on a weeknight and decided to help himself to one Michelle Mezzo, a Georgetown undergraduate. Ferguson grabbed her by the arm and, introducing himself as a member of Congress, pulled out his congressional ID card. Next, she recounted to the Washington Post, Ferguson offered her his congressional pin, which allows members to avoid metal detectors in the Capitol if she would come back and have a drink with him. The young lady declined to leave with Ferguson, but affixed the pin to her shirt and refused to give it back unless he apologized. The congressman, through his aides, disputed Mezzo's account, though he had no good explanation for how his pin wound up on her shirt. Undisputed, that Mezzo was offered a $50 gift certificate to return the pin and that she relinquished it only after police arrived. Power may be the ultimate aphrodisiac, as Henry Kissinger put it. This is the mantra of Potomac Man, but it doesn't necessarily apply at the Rhino Bar. Still, with hard work and proper incentives, Washington love sometimes blossoms into storybook endings. Consider the tale of Roy Blunt and Abigail Perlman. A love story as heartwarming as that of John and Abigail Adams in Revolutionary days. By other cultures' aesthetic standards, Blunt would not have been considered a desirable mate when he caught Perlman's eye. He was in his 50s, had been married to the same woman for 35 years, and had had a kidney removed and surgery for colon cancer. But Perlman was no ordinary woman. She was the top lobbyist for Altria, Philip Morris's parent company, and Roy Blunt had the power to help the tobacco company. Perlman struck up what the Washington Post discreetly described as a personal relationship with Blunt, who in late 2002 became the third ranking leader in the House of Representatives. Within hours of that promotion, Blunt gave Perlman the Washington equivalent of a diamond engagement ring he secretly inserted into a bill creating the Department of Homeland Security two provisions that would help Philip Morris sell more cigarettes. Blunt naturally said this had nothing to do with Perlman, nor the fact that his son was also a lobbyist for the company. Neither was it related to the more than $150,000 Philip Morris had given to Blunt-affiliated political committees in the previous 2 years. It's good policy, came Blunt's inevitable if implausible explanation. The Philip Morris provision never made it into law, but good policy makes for good bedfellows. 5 months later, Blunt got a divorce from his wife, and 6 months after that, Blunt and Perlman, 12 years her lover's junior, were wed at the Four Seasons in Georgetown. In celebration of the nuptials, the House Ethics Committee granted Blunt's request for a waiver exempting him from rules that would have forced him to disclose the biggest wedding gifts the happy couple received, even those from lobbyists. the St. Louis Post-Dispatch reported that their bridal registries at Neiman Marcus and William Sonoma alone showed gifts exceeding $12,000. It was, by Washington standards, a happy ending for all concerned, with the possible exception of the first Mrs. Blunt. Blunt has since been elevated to House Majority Leader, which means it cannot be said without a hint of disrespect that the House's second-ranking lawmaker is in bed with a lobbyist. There was a time when a sex scandal meant disgrace, when House Ways and Means Chairman Wilbur Mills was pulled over by police at the Tidal Basin. He was found to be with a stripper known as Fanny Fox, better known as the Argentine Firecracker. Mills was gone 2 years later. In 1976, similarly, House Administration Chairman Wayne Hayes resigned after it was reported that he had put on his staff, for amorous purposes, 27-year-old Elizabeth Ray, who famously boasted, "I can't type, I can't file, I can't even answer the phone." Gary Hart, an adulterous Democratic senator from Colorado, saw his 1988 presidential campaign collapse after he was photographed with a 29-year-old model, Donna Rice, on his lap while aboard a boat improbably named Monkey Business. And Bob Packwood, an Oregon Republican accused of, among other things, fondling aides and forcing his tongue into their mouths, resigned in 1995 before he could be expelled. But for a Potomac man today, the sex scandal does not necessarily mean the end of a career. Ask Bill Thomas, the recently retired chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. In 2000, the California Republican was second in line to become the powerful committee's chairman. But then his hometown paper, the Bakersfield Californian, reported what had been rumored for a year, that the congressman, as one aide put it, was having an intensely personal relationship with a health care lobbyist, Deborah Steelman. Thomas's wife, meanwhile, had moved back to Bakersfield alone. By pure coincidence, naturally, Steelman was representing pharmaceutical companies just as Thomas's committee was working on prescription drug legislation. Thomas denied a potential conflict of interest, but he did not deny an affair with Steelman. In a statement alluding to personal failures, he argued that he was not swayed by pillow talk. "I've never let anyone substitute their judgment on public policy for mine," he said. No matter, the congressman, having demonstrated his virility, was given the chairmanship. Indeed, the casual observer of Potomac Man might well conclude that having a lobbyist for a lover is an asset that increases an office holder's power. Tom Daschle, the South Dakota Democrat who served as Senate Majority and Minority Leader, married a lobbyist after moving to Washington and divorcing his first wife. Dick Durbin, the Illinois Democrat who joined Senate leadership after Daschle's defeat, also has a lobbyist wife. The wives of Senator Byron Dorgan and Kent Conrad, both North Dakota Democrats, and Alaska Republican Ted Stevens, have also worked as lobbyists. Kit Bond, a Missouri Republican, separated from his wife in 1994 and, as a senator, married a Republican fundraiser in 2002. Diane Albo, the wife of Bush's 2000 campaign manager, Joe Albo, clearly wasn't very worried about perceptions. She registered as a utilities lobbyist in the Senate in September 2000, 4 months before her husband moved to Washington to head the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Similarly, Stephanie Herseth, a South Dakota Democrat running for Congress, fell in love with Max Sandlin, the congressman assigned by the Democratic leadership to be her mentor. Sandlin retired from Congress and joined Greenberg Torig, Jack Abramoff's former lobbying firm. Mentor and protege married in March 2007. And lobbyist Doris Matsui took things one step further. After the death of her husband, Robert Matsui, a Democratic congressman, the widow won an election to succeed him. With so many intensely personal relationships proving profitable for lobbyist and lawmaker alike, Potomac Man suffers little public disgrace for such actions. But some, perhaps remembering earlier sex scandals, still regard these relationships with guilt and shame. This explains why, just before the 2000 election, a 60 Minutes television crew caught Bud Schuster, a Pennsylvania Republican, hiding in the backseat of a female lobbyist's car as the lobbyist left home on 11 different mornings. The woman, Ann Eppard, had been Schuster's chief of staff when he was chairman of the House Transportation Committee. She left Schuster's office, but not Schuster, in 1994 and opened a transportation lobbying firm. The two continued to dine together frequently at the Capitol Grill, and Ephard introduced Schuster to several of her new clients.
She continued to advise Schuster's congressional staff about who should get a meeting with them, and her clients paid for a Christmas vacation in Puerto Rico for the Schuster family.
The House Ethics Committee called Schuster's behavior serious official misconduct and found the appearance of a conflict of interest. That appearance got a bit worse when 60 Minutes caught him in her car. Mike Wallace reported that Ephard would make several turns and then get out of the car and walk home, while Schuster, wearing a baseball cap, then drove Ephard's car to Capitol Hill.